You ready to join the evolution? Here we go. Welcome back, everybody, to the CJ Evolution Podcast. Patrick here. I know you got many options out there, a lot of podcasts, but thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. We continue to grow because of you, the listener and supporter. Thank you so much. One of the ways we grow is through ratings and reviews. If you have a moment, please head over to iTunes. You're going to see a link on the website. Rate and review the show. I sure would appreciate it. And please help CJ Evolution keep the lights on by becoming a patron. As you know, we've dedicated this podcast for all listeners free of charge, done it for almost 3 years now. We will continue to do so. But a little help can go a long way. Thank you for your support. You can check out the Patreon page on the CJ Evolution website, cjevolution.com, which brings me up to another exciting point. You can check out my new blog on the website, and it's up right now. The 5 top careers with criminal justice degrees in 2019. Check it out on the CJ Evolution podcast website, and I appreciate all the feedback. So excited to have my next guest on the show. You're going to love him. His name is Mike Gillette. He is the author of the super successful book, Mind Boss, Using the Tenets of Tough Thinking to Take Charge of Your Thoughts and Transform Your Life. You need to put the power of positive psychology and peak performance to work for you. With Mind Boss, Mike Gillette provides an action plan for unconditional achievement in any area you choose. And he's on the show right now, folks. I am super excited. Mike is a former Army paratrooper, SWAT commander. This guy's done it all. His life reads like an action story. Grab a notepad, take some notes from this amazing guest. Enjoy. Mike Gillette is on the show. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, I appreciate you being here, sir. I gave a little bit of a bio at the beginning of the show, but did I miss anything? Can you tell the audience a little bit more about Mike?
Well, I think as it relates to your audience, obviously the time that I spent in law enforcement, was sort of pivotal for my own personal development, as well as kind of informing everything else that I've done subsequent to that. The main thing that happened for me tangentially with my law enforcement time is that I got involved in training others very early on. And I realized I had an aptitude for that. I'd certainly had a passion for it. And that is something that continues to this day. Mm-hmm. I've always seen myself as a teacher. And that goes all the way back to my cop days. Mm-hmm. And everything else that I've done sort of subsequent to that is all really sort of an extension or an accident having to do with, sort of seeing myself in that teacher role.
Well, I appreciate you serving as a police officer, Mike. And the obvious question I always ask, especially when I have other Leos on the show, is why did you get in law enforcement? What was the reason? Did you always want to serve in law enforcement or be a cop? I mean, what was the reason?
No, it was as far away from my young life as it could be, both in terms of as an idea or a potential goal, or as something that was even possible for me. I think I was I got the urge, if you will, to pursue law enforcement, really to sort of save myself. I came from an extremely violent, chaotic upbringing, and the negativity that sort of accompanied all of that pursued me until at age 18, I unsuccessfully tried to take my own life. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was the most prodigious consumer of every toxic substance you can imagine. And then suddenly I wasn't. In my case, it was the result of going to church for the first time with my new girlfriend, mm-hmm. who is now my wife of 36 plus years. And in the sort of radical 180 that ensued, I decided that what I would want to do with my life, because I suddenly felt compelled to find something productive to do with my life, is What does every young cop say at every interview? Why do you want to be a cop? Well, I want to help you, right? We all say that.
Yeah.
And I think sincere, it certainly was. I mean, it's perhaps a naive sounding thing to say in retrospect, but at the time it was very sincere. It was really true for me.
Yeah.
I wanted to help people. And for whatever reason, that was the solution that fell out of the sky and landed on my head and just wouldn't go away.
Yeah. Well, thank God for your wife, because it sounds like she was the one that kind of opened up your eyes with that trip to church. And
in all,
that was on the right, that got you on the right path.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, talk a little bit about your military career, Mike, too, because I know you were a paratrooper in the Army, like I was.
Now, I didn't appreciate that, Patrick.
What's that?
I said, thanks for working that in. I would have brought it up anyway.
Oh, yeah.
we're a cocky bunch.
Yeah.
Basically, the Army was part of my intended path to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
I started testing at police agencies when I was really too young to do so, not technically, but practically.
Yeah.
And I did well enough, you know, in the written process, you know, to get myself into an interview. And I could tell that nobody was really taking it seriously, but there was one kindly state trooper that suggested, you know, you seem like an enthusiastic guy. You just need a little bit more mileage, maybe some college, you know, so perhaps some time in the military. Well, I didn't have money for college, but I knew that the military did, and that's where I went. So the military initially was going to be a means to generate funds for college, mm-hmm. so that I could ultimately become a cop. However, once I was introduced to the military, that just overtook me. It was amazing, overwhelming, positive experience for me. And I immediately decided that was going to be my career. I had some very amazing mentors at the 82nd. I was, as a infantry soldier, I was allowed to start taking classes on work time. There were some people that were, you know, shoving me hard towards becoming an officer. And when my original enlistment was up, I left active duty, RTC scholarship, and something called the simultaneous membership program and reserve unit, all of these things sort of helped me get various stipends because I was married at this point. I was going to become an Army officer. That lasted for one semester until I got really smashed up in a climbing accident and was medically processed out of the military seemingly forever. And there was no way I was ever going to be a cop. I had a broken back and, you know, screws holding my ankle together and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
It was just 4.5 subsequent years of diligence in opposition to every medical expert that had talked to me. The prognosis was, you'll walk again, you won't run. There's no more jumping out of airplanes for you, young man. So I not having a plan B and having a baby, mm-hmm. I you know, just wouldn't give up on that. So somehow I was able to reverse sort of my seeming physical circumstances to the point where in 1989 I was successfully hired, and then the momentum began. You know, I just started crushing goals and never really stopped.
Now, that's a perfect segue into your amazingly successful book, Mind Boss, which I got done reading it. I told you off the air, it's an amazing book, folks. You need to go pick up this book. How did you change your mindset, Mike? Because you broke your back, you were probably very low, you know, mentally you were at the bottom. You were like, all right, how the hell do I bring myself back up? And can you kind of talk about what was the catalyst behind the book? How did you write this masterpiece and get your mind in the place it needed to be?
Well, I think the life had to precede the book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so how did my mind get into the right place, or how did I keep it in the right place?
Mm-hmm.
It really goes back to when I reversed course at age 18. That was the big fundamental change for me. And then once I started moving towards, well, the metaphorical light, if you will, I liked how that felt. I liked how it felt to be strong, to think strong, to do strong things, to have, you know, strong aspirations, to be in the company of other strong people, Everything about that was profoundly appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which made, you know, navigating towards the Army a very easy and logical seeming thing to do. However, once I was confronted with, you know, that accident, that was probably my biggest test, mm-hmm. Mentally / emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And the what was difficult about it, you know, you're young. Your coping skills are not that well developed. And I was also isolated. One of the things that made leaving the military and moving to a college town very challenging is the military sort of, and you know this, there was this bubble. It mm-hmm. was a very self-contained universe. You know, we all looked alike. We all dressed alike. And we all had similar priorities and attitudes. And that was a very comfortable place to operate within.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the real world is far different. And college towns are slightly less real than the real world. And so that was a big transition. So when I was sort of busted loose from the military, that was sort of the last vestige of any connectivity I had with that previous life.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm just another college student. And even as a college student, I didn't fit in. I'm maybe a couple years older. I'm married. I have a baby. I don't drink. I don't do what college students do. I'm like, you know, it's what the positive outcome of that period is I really had to sort of sort myself out as an individual, and I had to sort of stand as an individual. But even the things that are good for us, you know, like some vegetables aren't necessarily pleasant in the moment.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of unpleasant moments.
Yeah.
The uncertainty, the fact that I felt like I had literally been pursuing, you know, my chosen purpose, this sort, you know, sort of mystical destiny that unfolded before me, because I was a kid. That's how I thought.
Yeah.
Now it's gone. Well, why is it gone? You know, did I not deserve it? You know, those sorts of weird thoughts that float through your head
yeah.
in difficult moments. And what am I going to do if I can't do that?
Yeah.
Well, what I kept coming back to is I don't want to have a normal job. I don't like the idea of being a normal person. I didn't really have a definition of what that was. I just knew that that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
It didn't feel strong. And I just, if it would kill me, I was not going to stop trying to claw my way back to where I had been, or at least a facsimile of that. And I had to be a physical person in order to be a cop.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a long, slow hike.
Yeah.
To get back to that point. And then once I got back to that point, I was absolutely never going to let it go, which is why, you know, at age 56, I do the kinds of things that, you know, lead reasonable people to say, why are you so crazy? Why are you so intense? And because I don't want to be anything else.
Yeah.
You know, now to each other, we're not crazy. To each other, this is normal. You know, but we're not like regular people.
Yeah.
I think that's why those of us are sort of attracted to, you know, lives of service, even when those can be difficult or those can be dangerous and so forth. You know, we're not yeah. in it for the gratitude and the back slapping. You know, it's a living. It's not a great living, but it's, you know, this is a lifestyle. This is a way of life.
Yeah.
And that was always so profoundly attractive to me. You know, the idea of living a life of meaning as opposed to just living.
Yeah.
If that
The one thing I loved about, I loved the whole book, but the way you started out the book, you talked about how you were, you know, this poor, scared, skinny kid growing up, and you, and I'm paraphrasing, but you walked by and you would look up at this big, huge, I can't remember, it was a mountain or something that you wanted to scale, but you were always afraid until you started doing it. And you started saying, all right, I'm going to do this, until you mastered your fear of heights, right?
Yeah, that's true. I do speak about, well, I was afraid of everything.
Yeah,
I had rational fear of heights as a kid, and that was something that just it plagued me to the point where I was probably just mad enough to, you know, fling myself at the rock in question, and, you know, and now suddenly we're doing that thing.
But you know, Mike, that a lot of people
at least the people, I met a lot of people in my life as you have. A lot of people would have said, screw that. I'm not doing that crap. I'm too afraid. You conquered it. You kept going, even though you were still afraid. And that's what got you past that fear, right? I mean, a lot of people wouldn't do that, at least in my opinion.
Well, I don't comment on what a lot of people won't do.
True, true, true.
There's a long list of things that I do that nobody should do.
Yeah.
That's what YouTube is for. The it, you know my story is a cautionary tale in many respects. But there's no question that the way that we deal with things is by dealing with things rather than avoiding things. And that may sound a bit pat and it may sound a bit obvious, but that is how that is done. Anybody in the police profession understands fear because I guarantee there's something about it that scares you, or it did at one point. Whether that was just simply the pressure of passing all of your exams in the academy, of not letting your shipmates down, whatever it is, there's something there that can be very frightening. And we know that, look, the job is the job. It's always going to be the job. If you want to have this amazing opportunity to do amazing, important things, you are going to have to do what cops do, what soldiers do, that you have to move to the danger. And I think that the typical cop has such a developmental leg up over regular people because, in your off time, or perhaps when you one day transition away from this job, and into other professions, you have built up this capacity to move towards the thing that is scary, move towards the danger, and that's just like it's a reflexive skill that you have. So the things that sort of petrify the typical person, be it I'm afraid to try for grad school, I'm afraid public speaking, the things that normal people are afraid of. Cops are like, if it can't kill me, then why am I even worried about it's like this person can't kill me, this person can't fire me, so whatever, and we can just go and we can do, and by going and doing, we can experience things.
But why do you think, because you talk about the five tenets in your book, which I agree with wholeheartedly. You talk about passion, preparing, planning, persistence, which is huge, and then the payoff. But why do you think some people, and I could speak for myself, Mike, because a handful of years ago, I would have been like, I'm scared to do this. Why do you think it's difficult for some people to take those steps forward to drastically improve their life? It's fear, right? Or fear-based?
Well, I do think it's fear, but the fear can be of a lot of things. I think that one of the things that I do now is I work with a lot of athletes, and these are the physically speaking, these are the chosen people. And if you've been successful in athletes, and I generally work with higher level athletes, so if you have been blessed in that way, your life has not perhaps been as difficult as it has been for the average person. Who doesn't like having a good athlete around? You're sort of first pick. You're probably just a little bit better looking. You're just things go well. Okay. So what surprised me when I first started working with athletes, and I started working with very high level athletes. So when I was still living in Las Vegas, the first athletes I were working with was fighters, and they were professional fighters. So there's somebody, okay, physically capable. That's a tough sport. You would that the typical fighter is going to be, that's a brave person. That's not somebody who's all bound up by fear. Well, guess again, because it still exists. It just manifests a little bit differently. It manifests in a way that perhaps we might not expect if we're sort of outside of that frame of reference. But the thing that I find with whether it's combat athletes or anyone else I might be happy to work with is what can be scary, what gets back to your question, Patrick, is exposing yourself to what you really want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why don't we do it? It's a protective mechanism. You know, that little voice in our head, it's not there because we have a negative personality. It's there because everybody has it. It's mm-hmm. there because centuries of human adaptation, you know, to each successive, you know, generation or period in civilization, you know, life has always been dangerous. And it is reasonable to assume that as we continue to thrive as a species, that our brains, you know, sort of pass along the things that worked, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of, you know, thousands of years ago, when you would wake up, you would look out onto, you know, either the tundra or the prairie or the forest or wherever you happen to live. And your thoughts weren't, you know, how am I going to self-actualize today? How am I going to boost my self-esteem? No, it was a, how can I not die today? Mm-hmm. What out there right now wants to kill me? What human wants to kill me? What animal wants to eat me? What vegetable wants to poison my ass, right? everything in the world could kill you. So what did we do? We started developing brains that became very oriented towards finding problems. And developing a problem-solving capacity. Okay, so flash forward, it's 2019. There's no practical outlet for that in the way that neurological programming was first sort of developed. So now what do? We look at mundane situations, and we develop problem-solving for, well, if I say this in front of the group, they might make fun of me, mm-hmm. or they might think I'm as clever as maybe they do currently. So we find new ways to be afraid. We find new ways to sort of limit ourselves aspirationally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that we're afraid of are oftentimes self-generated, and sometimes they're self-generated just because our minds are working overtime trying to solve problems.
Yeah, and it's...
And a lot of those problems aren't really... I don't want to say they're not really real because that sounds kind of cosmic, but they're not relevant necessarily.
And I think
so there's a lot of internal programming to overcome, and then there's sort of the secondary programming. Okay, what sort of messages did you absorb as a child? You know, what did your parents say to you? What did your teacher, your coaches say to you? Was it always, you know, productive? Was it always phrased in a way that sort of, you know, expanded your own beliefs and your own capabilities? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
Believe me, you are carrying that around. You don't forget anything.
Yeah.
You know, so our programs are very deep, even though we're not readily accessing a lot of the information that's contained within them.
Yeah. And I'm a big believer, Mike, that, you know, everybody has, or I think most people out there, well, I don't know. I can speak for myself. I think, you know, I have some toxic people in my life, and what I do is I take those people in increments. And mm-hmm. and I think you need to surround yourself with people who are pumping you up, not bringing you down.
I agree with that. The flip side is that we have to understand, you know, toxic people are an atmospheric constant.
Mm-hmm.
It's how we let those.
Exactly.
And certainly law enforcement is an amazing opportunity to be exposed to toxicity of a human type.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I can remember clearly my days on patrol really struggling with, you know, keeping my composure and not saying the wrong thing, because in the moment it would sort of be a therapeutic thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, I kept telling myself, if I lose a battle of wits with a moron, then who's the moron, right?
Yeah.
You know, if some knucklehead on the street can make you act like a buffoon, you need to, you know, hone your skills a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, so it was really sort of the job where I developed an objectivity that still serves me well to this day.
Yeah. And I think the older I get, Mike, is, you know, the more I realize, I've known this for a while now, You have to take action in your life if you want things to change. I mean, you say it, you talk about it in your book. Quit saying you're going to do some shit and just do it. Take the action. Just do it.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean?
Very much. The successes that I've had in life, I mean, granted, I think that I've had some extraordinary opportunities, but along with those opportunities, every time I had an at bat, I was ready.
Yeah.
And some of the things that I've done, which, you know, don't necessarily appeal or make sense, to a lot of folks. It's like if we're talking, you know, Guinness World Records, Ripley's mm-hmm. Believe It or Not. Those were things I did over the age of 50.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Okay. So, they're crazy and dangerous and all of that. But for me, because I am me, they were meaningful, you know, in some way. So I pursued them until, you know, I could sort of join that unusual club.
Yeah.
You will.
Yeah.
So anything that that is worthwhile to do, if it's worthwhile, it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
And I think things should be hard and we should pursue them nonetheless. And we should enjoy every good thing that comes with it and learn from every challenge that comes with it. And, you know, just I fully intend to go down swinging at the end of this, you know, life journey.
Yeah.
I never want to stop. I always want to be learning something. I want to be doing something and not just talking about something.
Yeah.
That's sort of what keeps me going.
And persistence. There's a part in your book where you talk about, you know, I can't remember what it was, Mike, a piece of metal that you were trying to bend and you couldn't bend it and you kept going back and back and back and back until you did it.
Yeah, that was when I got involved in Feats of Strength. I got involved in that at the tender age of 46, and it was just sort of a personal quest sort of thing. And I never really even thought that I was going to be able to do any of that, let alone, you know, start doing some of those things in the context of public demonstrations or on TV or, you know, some things I've gone on to do. So there's a little story in there. You know, one of the first things I learned how to do was bend a steel bar.
Yeah.
And it didn't come easily. And I have friends that can bend steel bars way better than me. And they're smarter and handsomer too, but what are you going to do? And then I saw a guy on TV bend two bars. They were taped together, and I just thought, holy crap, that's amazing. I couldn't fathom that. So I started chasing that, and I got there quicker than I expected. And when I did, I phoned a friend of mine. This is the guy who taught me how to break bricks. You know, most people who break bricks do, you know, the martial arts way. They spend years conditioning the body and blah, blah, blah. I learned how to break a stack of bricks in about 2.5 hours. I don't recommend it. You know, there's ways.
Don't try this at home, folks.
Yeah, there's the sensible way, which is really not that sensitive, and then there's just the, you know, crazy man swing for the fences way, and that's how I do it. You know, guys who know what they're doing will watch videotape of me, and they'll just cringe. It's like, dude, you should be like shattering all of your bones, and I will say something profound like, whatever. But this guy was no stranger to Feats of Strength. His name's John Bruni. He's an amazing guy. And when I told him that I'd gotten two bars, he said, hey, that's cool. I bet you'll get three. And I said, what? And, you know, we get into this argument about three bars. Like, I saw a guy do two, and I don't think that there's too many guys who do two. He's talking about three. Well, as implausible as that seemed, you know, as the story plays out, I started chasing that, you know, just periodically. And it took a couple years, and eventually I got it. And I tried it in public several times and failed miserably. But it was really just, I think, about the integrity of the effort. And it's like, look, hey, I'm in front of these people. I'm not a magician. None of this is fake. Maybe this will go. Maybe it won't. Let's see what happens. And many several times nothing happened other than, you know, my head turned red and people probably got very concerned. But then it worked. And then, you know, it worked again. I had some bicep surgery because I was acting crazy and ripped the bicep off my arm. And then it worked even after that. So yeah, persistence is huge. Now, why would anyone chase something like that? It honestly doesn't matter. I have a reason for doing it, so I do it, and it gives me very specific, measurable milestones. It's something that it's equal parts discipline and pain tolerance. Yeah. There's obviously strength to it, but that's not really the X factor. The X factor is overriding the discomfort and just the illogical nature of some of these stunts.
Yeah, and I'm looking at it from the lens of persistence. I mean, it's amazing feat of strength, but I'm looking at it from, okay, you wanted to do this, you got it in your mind, and you were going to do it, whatever. That's where I'm looking from. I think it's amazing, but I'm looking at it, okay, it's one of the tenets that you talk about in your book, the power of persistence. Again, getting on that saddle, and that could have been the time when you were in front of people, Mike, you know this, you probably had those thoughts, I imagine. I know I would. Shit, I couldn't do this. I mean, I'm embarrassed. I'm not going to do it again. But you kept going back after it. And that's where success happens.
I think that's a really good point. And the other thing, see, for me, everything I do, it either works or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Now, it works more often than it doesn't. But there's times where, not every brick breaks in the stack. I've hurt myself in front of people a couple of times. It's not an embarrassment thing because, again, if I was a magician, everything has to turn out perfectly, sure, or it was a successful performance. Well, I'm not a performer, number one. Number two, these are experiments.
Yeah.
And, whoever's in the room, whether it's a men's group or I'm in a juvenile detention facility or I'm in a church or wherever it is, the point is not for me to be like a super cool guy.
Oh, sure.
The point is these are pretty extreme things to do, and they make no sense for a normal person, much less somebody who grew up as physically unremarkable as I did, and I'm an average sized guy. I'm on the far side of 50, and it's just more of a mental exploration, really, mm-hmm, than anything else.
Yeah.
And so even if something doesn't go, it's not unsuccessful, because what's the success part is the application of sincere effort.
And I agree.
So as long as that is authentic, you can't fail at anything. You just go at it and you go at it hard. Oh, but I didn't get it. Yeah, but you went at it.
Yeah.
And most people don't.
Yeah, and I was going to say, that's the kicker.
Yeah, that's why. If you live that way, you win every time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I think it's, that's a less obvious thing for most people.
Yeah.
But it has validity for me, and it has validity for a lot of the kinds of people that I associate myself with.
I love it. So you got this successful book out there, Mike. Any aspiring or any advice for people out there wanting to write a book? You've written a book. Was it difficult to write a book? Any advice you'd want to give people out there?
Okay. And then remind me how everybody can get the book for free for a limited time.
Of course.
So first off, when I was a cop, everyone told me the same thing that they've told every cop who starts telling cop stories at a party. Oh, my God, dude, you should write a book.
I never heard that before.
I firmly believe that most cops should write a book.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not special in that regard. Now, I actually have a father who was a retired college professor. He wrote two textbooks, which have stayed in print for decades. His grandfather was a college professor who wrote two college textbooks, which stayed in print for a really long time. And I think it was around 1995, I'm deep in the middle of my cop days, and I'm talking to my dad on vacation, and I said, I think I want to write a book. I've thought about it, but I really think that there's something there. And he said, well, let me give you a piece of advice. Now, this is for every one of your listeners, okay? He looked at me, and he said this. He said, writers write.
Okay.
And I just went, wow, that, right? He said, writers write, meaning a lot of people talk about it, but writers write.
Yeah.
And I had a very pivotal meeting. One of my martial arts mentors, a guy named Hawk Hawkeye, who came along at a very important stage of my development martial arts wise. And he was a very accomplished martial artist. He was a veteran Texas cop, Dallas area. Mm-hmm. And he had books. Now, when I met him in 97, he had books. Now he's got books. Oh, my God. But he was still a cop. He was writing books. And this is how hard he went at writing. He wrote a detective novel, had it published now way before, Amazon and computers and everything else. Getting a book into print cost a small fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And there were what they called vanity publishers, which is what we call self-publishing now. But it was extraordinarily difficult. It's kind of like if you had a garage band, we should make a record. And then you pay like $5,000 to get 200 records that sit in a stack in your garage for months. I thought people would buy these. Anyway, you don't do it for that. You do it just to do it. Anyway, he wrote a detective novel, had it published in hardback, illustrated the cover himself because he's kind of clever like that, and it cost him a small fortune. He wrote a book on how to find missing persons all on his own dime.
Wow.
Then he started writing martial arts books, which are photo intensive and were very expensive. But then he was able to start selling those online because the internet had happened. And now he's got this series of novels, a turn of the century lawman, kind of a Western thing. But what was important about meeting Hawk is that he was a cop. He was still on the job and he was writing, and he was writing like a fiend.
Yeah.
I was in awe of that. And he introduced me to a friend of his, Jerry Van Cook, who was like this legendary narcotics officer in Oklahoma, who had two books out and under another name had like 20 plus novels in the Mac Bolan Executioner series. So I met these crazy prolific cops that were writing, and they're still on the job.
Wow.
And that basically showed me, you can do this. Mm-hmm. There are that are doing this.
Yeah.
And then I met Donald Harstad, who was a high school classmate of my mother, who was a small town county deputy who was injured on the job, back injury. He was off work for 11 days. He wrote a novel called 11 Days about a small town county sheriff whose jurisdiction is overrun with vampires. It was optioned by Warner Brothers, and then he gets this crazy contract, and he's banging out a novel every year and a half, in hardback. He's doing book signings all over at Barnes & Noble and everything else. These are cops I knew that were writing their butts off, and they were good at it. I'm nowhere near as good a writer as any of those guys, but – I'm also not trying to occupy that fiction niche, which I just don't have the skill set for, inclination. But like a lot of cops, like a lot of people, I had something that I thought would be helpful for other people to know.
Yeah.
And that was the motivation behind, whether it's Mind Boss, or my strength training books, all that. I've got a lot of DVDs and so forth, sort of in the same personal development realm. That's what drives it. Ultimately, I still see myself as a teacher.
Yeah. But take action, right?
Because people are doing it.
Yeah. Take action. So you wanted me to remind you, Mike, how do people get a free copy of your book?
Right. If you go to MikeGillette.com right now, MikeGillette.com, MikeGillette.com, spelled Gillette, just like any number of products probably in your medicine chest. Go there right now, and you can get a free copy of Mind Boss sent to you. It's like a physical copy book. Just cover the shipping, and we'll take care of everything else.
Yeah. Well, Mike Gillette, thank you, sir, for taking the time to come on the show. Any final words of wisdom you got for the listener?
Writers write. Don't forget that one. And go.
Mike Gillette, thank you, sir. so much. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your book you've given to the world. Much success to you in the future, sir, and take care.
Thanks so much, Patrick.
All right, bye-bye.
Such a great interview with Mike Gillette. Hope you enjoyed. And some of the big takeaways from the book are passion first, prepare well, plan for success, perfecting persistence. We talked about that. And number five, payoff. The five tenets that Mike talks about in his amazing book. Pick it up, folks. I read it. I couldn't put it down. Mind Boss. It's in the show notes. Stay tuned for more amazing guests.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.